Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our friend from Carrboro, Thomas Mills, is the founder and publisher of politicsnc.com, which is a website of commentary and analysis. And Thomas has experience all over the map on politics, particularly in North Carolina. And so I always try to read what he writes, and it's always informative. And I've invited him here to sort of help me size up the recent elections and what it means for the various parties, political politicians, and for us as citizens. Thomas Mills, welcome.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
Well, size up the recent election. What, if anything, surprised you?
I don't know what. I don't know how much surprised me, because I got more surprised in 2016 than I've ever been. So I didn't go into this election expecting a whole lot. I think that my lesson from 2016 is have no expectations. But I think what did happen is we saw a huge pushback to what we've seen over the last 2 years in the Trump administration. I really think that this election was a referendum on Trump and his behavior, and I think it was a reflection of the Democratic base getting fired up literally right after Trump got sworn in. I think the Women's March was almost the kickoff of what some people called the resistance, but what it, at the end of the day, was a huge Democratic turnout. The turnout nationally and in North Carolina was larger than any midterm that we've seen in decades. And my experience in politics is when we have a high voter turnout, Democrats do well, and that's what we saw last week.
Well, it's a referendum on Trump was the president, at least initially, accepted that and said he had won the referendum.
Right,
It was a resounding approval. Is there any way for him to legitimately claim a victory?
No, you know, this is a guy who believes that if he says something long enough, it'll become true, or at least become true in the minds of certain people. And I think he's got a core base of supporters that will basically believe anything he says. And I think that's who he was talking to when he said that. The other thing that happened, though, was the election has gotten increasingly good for Democrats. I think the night of the election, it looked like Republicans might have picked up 4 Senate seats, and now it looks like they're going to pick up 1 or 2. And Democrats at the time, initially, people were saying, well, it looks like we're going to be between 25 and 30 seats. Then it got between 30 and 35, and now people are saying it could get as high as 40 seats. Congressional seats. So when Trump made that statement, it may have looked a little bit better for him than it looks today. I read something recently that said that he's retreated into resentment and anger over the results.
One topic, if this happened to be a referendum on President Trump, what does that do in terms of what the elected representatives should do now? Particularly those in the House where the Democrats have a majority, does that just mean they should resist him, investigate him, or does it mean that they should try to impeach him?
I don't think they should try to impeach him. I don't think they've got a better person to run against in 2020 than Donald Trump. So I think they should investigate him. I mean, we need to know what's going on. I think part of what we saw was the American public saying there's no oversight. Nobody's checking this president. And so Democrats need to get into office, and they need to do that. They need to check the president. They also need to push their agenda. Republicans ran for years on killing Obamacare, and that clearly did not work. And I don't think we're going to see that anymore. But Democrats can start to look for ways to make that program better or look at whatever comes after it. But people right now are not happy with their health care. And they weren't happy with it before the recession. I mean, if you remember in 2008, when Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were embroiled in a primary, the whole debate was how are we going to fix health care? And then the economy collapsed, and everybody got distracted by this huge recession. And Obamacare, though, was really a campaign promise that Democrats made. Republicans have tried to dismantle it ever since it was passed, and it's not working as well as it could if we had a little bit of cooperation across the aisle. So I think that those are the types of issues that Democrats need to look at in addition to holding the president accountable.
Well, that raises a very interesting topic. It's a little bit off of my schedule, but what about health care? The Democrats now have the majority. They can initiate these improvements to Medicare to take care of what we might call legitimate criticisms of the program, but they would probably have not much cooperation from the Senate or from the president. So although both the Republicans in the Senate and the president himself have said that they could come make a deal, is there a possibility of a deal?
You know, I think when you have divided government, you shouldn't have, again, keep your expectations in check. But if the American people are saying that health care is their number one policy priority and Republicans and Donald Trump ignore it, that's going to hurt them in 2020, particularly if you have a Democratic House that's putting out proposals that look like they're going to help Americans, and the Senate says they can't do anything about it. They run the risk of a backlash.
What are the kinds of things that the Democrats could propose to improve the health plan, and that the public would agree with?
You know, I think one thing we ought to have is a public option, and it was something that was debated when the program was first put in place. A lot of what got dismantled happened kind of at the state level when the Supreme Court said that that states did not have to implement Medicare. Expand Medicaid, and they did not have to set up state exchanges. All of a sudden, you had a different program than what I think Democrats envisioned when it was originally passed. So you can't force states to do certain things, but there are things that they can do at the federal level to try to shore it up a little bit. I'm not a healthcare expert, but
well, I won't push you on it. But I'm thinking about from the political side,
yeah.
Whether there's any political milk to be had from proposing improvements,
right? And I think if you push a public option, if you give people the idea that you've got an option to private insurers, and people come to that, and you start to build a really large pool of people, you may see prices go down. Now that's an anathema to Republicans, because what they're going to see is a program that's a publicly funded program competing with private sector folks who are beholden to shareholders and that type of thing. So, the Republicans will push back on that pretty hard. But I think it's a starting point. I mean, we've got to figure out a way to reduce premiums to some degree and check the rising cost of health care.
What would the public option look like? Would it be like this Medicare for all idea?
I don't think it's necessarily a Medicare for all type thing. I think it's a larger pool that people have an option to buy into that's run by the government. And you probably, in exchange for lower prices, you're probably going to give up a little bit of your choice. But look, in private insurers, we give up choice. You know, it's not like the private sector says, "Oh, go see anybody you want." I've got insurance company, and I need to get something done. I get past my initial provider. then I got to find somebody who's in who takes my insurance. So it's not like the private sector is providing as much choice as they would like to demand.
Well, I'm interested in the medical debate to come, and we'll get you back when it gets to be on the table. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Thomas Mills, lives with us in Carrboro, and he runs an organization and a website called politicsnc.com, which has got a lot of regular commentary and news about politics. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Thomas Mills. I'm going to stop with all the long descriptions. You're just a political junkie and expert.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Hack.
You're a junkie who knows what's going on, and I'm trying to exploit you and to get you to share with some of our listeners your insights about the recent election. We're talking about it from the federal standpoint and what's going to happen in Congress. One of the things that is sort of first on the agenda for Democrats in the House, at least, is the selection of a leader.
Right.
And there is a little bit of controversy about it, because Nancy Pelosi, in some quarters, is unpopular. Some of the Republicans ran against her and forced Democratic candidates to say they would never vote for her.
Right.
So where does that – how will that work out?
You know, I think Nancy Pelosi is a very savvy leader. I would be very surprised if she's not the next speaker. And she does draw some fire for a lot of different reasons. She's from San Francisco, and just by virtue of being from San Francisco, she's a boogeyman or boogeyman. But the right loves to bash, you know, San Francisco values. But I think she's going to end up being speaker. One thing is nobody's emerged to oppose her, and if you don't see somebody step up, then there's really nobody for the opposition to vote for. I think you've got a lot of freshmen who ran saying even some sitting members ran saying they wouldn't vote for Nancy Pelosi, who are in a sticky situation. But there are ways to get around that. One is maybe they don't show up for the vote. Maybe you know, there's
– Well, they're going to vote for the Republican candidate. For
right,
speaker.
Exactly. And I guess the fear gets to be that the Republicans can nominate somebody themselves and stick together, and if enough Democrats peel off, then you could have a Republican speaker with a Democratic majority, and that would not work out too well either.
Do you know – I don't know. I assume that the speaker has to have a clear majority – of votes. It wouldn't be one where you got the most votes. It would be you'd have to get all.
I think you have to have a clear majority of but it's not just of your caucus. Whereas, right. I think today both Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell came out as leaders of their respective caucuses in the Senate, but it was just a caucus vote. Nancy Pelosi can't just go in there and get the votes of the majority of the votes of the Democratic caucus. She has to get a majority of the votes of the member of Congress.
So, but Thomas, at the end of the day, there will be one nominee,
right,
who's been endorsed by the Democratic caucus, and then there'll be one endorsed by the Republicans. And there may well be a fringe candidate,
right,
who's
right,
nominated by a minority of the Democrats who would be on there, and then you'd have the election, and these dissident Democrats, at least as far as Pelosi's concerned, could vote against her.
And right, and then vote.
In the runoff, they would say, well, I wasn't going to vote for the Republican.
Right. I think that's some – if you remember, North Carolina Congressman Heath Shuler ran against her back about 2010, I think it was, or 2012. That didn't go too far.
Whoever the leaders happen to be, what other than health care, we mentioned that, what do Democrats want to do, if anything, in the Congress, other than complain about Trump?
Well, he certainly gives them a lot to complain about. So, you know, I think – there's some big issues that I think need to be addressed. that could probably help both sides. I mean, we've got $100 billion deficit now, and we've got this huge debt. We're going to be paying more money for debt service than we are for military expenditures.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's where I'm thinking about that. This is the most irresponsible thing that I've seen done in a long time that hadn't gotten the public uproar, and that is to provide tax cuts for rich people that will be paid for by our children and grandchildren. Nobody seems to care. And how would Democrats raise, or would Democrats have the courage to say, we want to take away those tax cuts because they were because even Republicans know that's not, we got to raise the money to pay for what we're spending.
Right. I mean, what Republicans keep saying is that we're spending, they point to two things. They point to, Social Security and Medicare as entitlement programs that are getting out of control, and that's not exactly accurate, but that's what they point to. And they are growing, and we do have an aging population. We do have a population that's living a lot longer. I mean, these programs were not set up to sustain people for 30 years, and that's what's happening. People are retiring at 65 and dying at 95. It wasn't, back in the day, you retired at 65 and dead by 70, supported you for 5 years. It's a different world. But So that's where the Republicans would say that we need to figure out how to cut that back.
That would be an agreement that we would have. It would just be a question of what we do about it.
Right, exactly. And I think there may be some places for agreement there. I think that we certainly need to raise the cap to make sure that the middle class. I mean, income inequality is a huge problem. And it's been a problem. It's going to continue to be a problem. And we can't continue to see too much money being funneled to the very richest Americans without them picking up some of the share of paying for this debt and deficit. So, I think there's some compromises in there. I mean, this is very unpopular with my side, but maybe you do raise the retirement age a little bit. But the problem with raising the retirement age, though, is it's one thing for people like me who sit in front of a computer all day to say I'm going to work till I'm 70. It's another thing if you've been if you're hauling bricks all day and saying you're going to work till 70, your body gives out, and you don't have if you're working in a very physical field, then at 65 you are worn out. Even if you live to 90, you're worn out.
Well, just to highlight that point. I've had an easy life. I'm gonna live a long time, and in essence, I'm gonna take more than I put in Social Security, or at least I think.
Right.
I might get sick and die tomorrow.
Yeah.
But the really hardworking people have a hard time making it to 65 sometimes, and so that's a real challenge,
right,
to fairness.
And there's also things like means testing. I mean, we've got – I read something – this has been a few years ago, but we're watching over – maybe it's – I'm getting old. Maybe 20 years ago I read it, but we're going to see the largest transfer of wealth from the generation, what we call the greatest generation, the post-World War II generation, to their – heirs, we're going to see the largest transfer of wealth in history. And so
because why?
Because we created an incredible amount of wealth in this country.
It was essentially eliminated the estate tax.
Right, exactly. We haven't asked those people to pay it. I mean, in 1980 we made a decision, and We elected Ronald Reagan, and we restructured our tax system in such a way that we shifted the burden from the wealthiest Americans in corporate America onto the middle class. Republicans call that fair. I call that unfair. And that is our fundamental disagreement. I was asked at a forum a few months ago if I could undo one single thing, what would you undo? I'd undo supply side economics. I think it's been a disaster for our country. I think it's caused the division that we've seen. It's caused the income inequality. It's left way too many people behind, and it's benefited way too few people.
The supply side is essentially cut taxes and
cut taxes for the wealthy.
And the economy will grow.
Right. I mean, it's the belief that if we eliminate taxes for the wealthiest people and what they would call the wealth creation people, then all that they will go out and create all kinds of jobs, make our economy hum, and all of that's going to trickle down and everybody's going to do well. The problem is that it only trickles down so far, and then it stops. And so what you end up having is an expanded middle class, upper middle class. I mean, there's no question that our upper middle class today is larger than it was in the 1960s and 70s. But what we've got is a lower middle class, a working class that has not kept up. Their wages have been flat, and yet at the same time, nobody has pensions anymore. Nobody has or the health care is getting less and less. And you know, and Republicans don't want to do anything about it. You start asking them, it's like, okay, companies don't offer pensions anymore. Where did that money go? They'll tell you, well, it went to health care. And we go, oh, great, so let's fix health care. And they go, oh, no, we don't want the government involved in that. So, you know, somewhere there's got to be some give. Somewhere we have got to help this mass of middle class and working class people who have not benefited from an economy that's been it's been pretty healthy with the exception of 2008 since 1980, but it's been disproportionately distributed. And
I love this passion. No, I mean, I'm serious. But so now back into your seat as rather than an inspirer of ideological inspirationalist, pragmatically, will the Democratic victory in the House bring about conversations along the lines that you've had just now about how to attack the inequities that have developed as a result of
I think there'll be some. You know, we Democrats are a very big tent. I mean our problem is, somebody said something talking about the Republican Civil War. He said, "You don't have a Civil War." I said, "I know we got 8 Civil Wars, but you know, when you're a coalition of 2 or 3 groups, it's everybody shooting at each other. When you're a coalition of 25, it's everybody shooting in every direction. So." But we have such a big tent that I think you're going to see some debate about it, and I think it's healthy. I mean, you know, I don't like some of the terminology. I think kind of our more left flank likes to call itself democratic socialist. Those aren't Democrat. Look. Providing health care for people is not socialism.
It is, right.
You're describing yourself poorly and giving your enemies ammunition. But I think there are things that we can do very specifically. One is address health care. I think that's a crucial thing. The other thing, though, is in this economy, I mean, a lot of what we're facing, in addition to what I feel like the inequality is this massive shift in our economy into a knowledge-based economy. I mean, we've got to get people better educated. You know, we can't just allow people. When I grew up, you could get out of high school and go to work in a textile mill and have a pretty decent life. You know, you might have both your parents working in a mill, but you could buy a small house, raise your kids, have a decent life, and go along. Today, we don't have jobs like that, or very, very few. You need a lot of training. And I'm not saying everybody needs to go to a 4-year degree, but I am saying that everybody needs to come out of school without a bunch of debt that leaves them stuck for the next 30 years. Kids my daughter's age come out of college with debt the size of a mortgage. That's obscene. You know, and we're putting less money into higher education than we've ever put in. And so we got to fix some of these things. And these are things that Democrats can address. I'm not a big fan of debt-free college, but I'm a big fan of debt-free college. I'm not a fan of everybody gets free college. I think if you can pay for college, you should pay for college. But I don't think you should come out of there with $100,000 worth of debt.
I really hate to interrupt. I love passion, and I love it, the identification of the issues that all Americans should be worried about. But I've gone over time. If you joined us late, the person you've been listening to is Thomas Mills. He is a Carver-based political consultant, and he and I will continue our conversation after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with a local political consultant and activist, Thomas Mills. Thomas, I guess if I don't give you a plug on your website, you'd fire me. But if you'd like to learn more, his website is politicsnc.com. And it's a collection of commentary, not just by Thomas, but by some of his associates on the recent political trends, like some of the ones we're talking about. And I'd love to talk about the national political consequences of the election, but we'd be here forever, if we did. So, one of the surprising aspects of this election as follows. I held no hope that that a Democratic candidate could come close in a Republican state like Texas. I had absolutely no hope that a black woman progressive candidate in Georgia could come within a hair of winning the governor's race. And, I don't think she'll win, but in any event, so very close in a state that's a little bit like North Carolina in the sense. That, and then in Florida, the idea that an African-American candidate with progressive leanings and talking progressive could almost win the governor's race in Florida. Those things, I've got to turn around my thinking about what's possible in politics in North Carolina. And what happened?
We are in the middle of a huge political realignment, and I think Donald Trump is a symptom of that realignment more than a cause of it, though I think he may have sped things up. But the shift is really it's a broadening of the Democratic coalition to include lots of college-educated white people. And you're seeing that in suburban areas. I did work in a Georgia district just north of Atlanta, which is very suburban. It was a state house district that fell within that district that I call it the Ossoff district. Tom Price was the congressman from there, and he went to the Trump administration. He was one of the first to have to leave because he was using too many chartered flights. But he had a special election. It got a lot of attention. And Ossoff, the Democrat, lost by a little bit. Well, we won in that district and beat Tom Price's wife in a state house district. The Democrat who ran against the woman who won, her name was Handel, the Republican, she lost that district. So what you're seeing are these suburban districts, suburban areas that have largely been outside of the Democratic coalition, that were kind of upper middle class white folks, very professional, who've been voting Republican since Reagan, all of a sudden are moving back and starting to vote Democratic. And it's especially true in these fast growing areas like suburban Atlanta. But it's also the fastest growing state in the country, I think, is Texas, or if it's not the fastest, it's one of the fastest. So all of a sudden, you've got areas all over Texas, Houston, Dallas, Austin, San Antonio, all these areas that are growing really fast, you're seeing those these people start to vote Democratic. And you also saw a huge increase in Latino turnout this time. And in a state like Texas, that's a big that makes a big difference. I mean, I think I've always said that Georgia was about a decade behind North Carolina, and North Carolina is about a decade behind Virginia. And
you hold to that still?
I think that's pretty true. It may be a little longer than a decade, but you see very similar trends. I mean, that you've got kind of concentrated urban areas that are growing really fast with a lot of newcomers, very diverse, and then lots of really traditional rural areas outside that are still very conservative and very Republican. And in Virginia, basically, it's anything north of Richmond now. And then in North Carolina, it's what we call the I-85 corridor. And you throw in Asheville and maybe some of Wilmington, and all of a sudden you've got a pretty pretty good progressive base. In Georgia, it's Atlanta. I mean, Atlanta's just becoming this huge metropolis, stretches all the way up to Athens almost now. And those people are starting to vote Democratic. And I think you will see Georgia contested as a presidential election in 2020. Florida's always going to be a contentious race.
So we'll have Virginia, North Carolina. I'm assuming that North Carolina will be competitive. Georgia.
I think people will be looking at Georgia
and Florida. So South. What is this? South becoming Democratic again?
Yeah. It is. It's
not the same Democratic Party.
Not the same Democratic Party, but it's somewhere.
But I mean, aren't you? I mean, you're just. That's not really happening, is it?
What that?
Yeah, that we're becoming. I mean, that's not.
Look, we got a Democrat as U.S. Senator of Alabama. I mean, it's the world's changing.
All right. Well, now you got me off my. And I apologize because people want to hear you talk about what's interesting to you. But what's interesting to me, you bring up the Alabama U.S. Senator, which was a fluke.
It was a fluke.
But now we do have this contest coming up in Mississippi.
Right.
Where an African American. Very talented, experienced, I think a attractive Democratic African-American candidate is running against, well, I don't want to get sued for libel, but maybe not the best, a woman who is not as articulate as you would want if you were
right.
a Republican. So in my dreamland, Democrat can't win. Mississippi County.
It seems like a long shot. Seems difficult. She's not as flawed as Roy Moore was in Alabama. So I think that's still a stretch for Democrats. There was a guy. I mean this was kind of a this is really a special election that they're having down there. And there was the general election that we had everywhere else was a runoff down there. I mean, a first primary down there. And there was a Republican that was very far to the right that I think Democrats were probably hoping to have to run against. And then it would be a different ballgame. But I think it's very difficult for Democrats. Mike Espy, is that his name?
Yeah.
That's down there. I think it's hard for Espy to win that seat. But look. After what we just went through, you can bet your bottom dollar they're about to send a whole bunch of people down there to try.
If you joined us late, I'm talking politics with the Carrboro's leading political consultant, Thomas Mills, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Thomas Mills. We're talking politics. And Thomas Mills, who lives in Carrboro, is I've accused you of being a political junkie, but you're really a political expert and an activist all your life in politics, and both passionate and wise. And so thanks again for coming.
Thank you.
We talked about the recent election and looking at the future for politics in North Carolina, particularly with respect to the elections in 2020. What did we learn, or what did the election in 2018 in North Carolina confirm in terms of what we can expect?
Well, I think if you're a Republican in North Carolina, you've got to be very concerned about 2020 because we just saw a midterm election where Democrats have traditionally done poorly in midterms in North Carolina, where more Democrats voted, more people voted for Democrats for state House and state Senate, even though they won a majority of the seats. You still had more Democrats voting for them. I think the best election to look at is kind of what we would call a generic ballot, was a court of appeals seat where the Democrat got 51% of the vote and the Republican got 49% of the vote. It was John Arrowood, and I can't remember the Democrat, and I can't remember the Republican's name. But even a junkie like me forgot they were on the ballot just about until I went into the ballot booth. No, I mean, the voting booth. Nobody was paying any attention. So if people went in there and just voted their preference, they voted, 51% of them voted for a Democrat.
You argue that that was a generic race where people disclosed what their political if there's an R and a D and
right.
unknown candidates, these people
they
chose
voted
based on their
yeah.
preferences.
A majority chose a Democrat. So if you're running in 2020, when we have every council of state seat, all these, you know, lieutenant governor, secretary of agriculture, secretary of public instruction, or superintendent of public instruction, all these seats, secretary of labor or commissioner of labor, all these seats are open, and they're all statewide ballots. Well, if 2020 looks like 2018, those people on those down ballots are probably going to be in trouble because we're going to have Roy Cooper's going into this thing in great shape. If anybody gets credit for what just happened, it's Cooper, because he raised the money. It was his organization that recruited the candidates. Democrats competed in every single House and Senate race in the state. That forced Republicans who had less resources to spend money in places they had no intention of spending them. So what you've got is a very popular governor who's clearly the leader of the party, running for re-election with a very energized base. And you're going to have a U.S. Senate race, and you're going to have a presidential race going full speed in North Carolina in 2020. We will be one of the top races in the country. I saw somebody who listed the races that would make a difference in 2020. He said there's six. He said ignore every state except for these six, and North Carolina was right dead in the middle of them. So, you know, the attention's going to start almost as soon as the votes get settled here. And it bodes well for Democrats, I think. It gives them a great place to start. But 2 years is a long time, and my party can screw up a lot of things between now and then. Yeah. So,
well, there were gains in the state legislature.
Yes, that's right.
That would be encouraging for Democrats. On the other hand, And there'll be battles about redistricting, and
yep.
there probably will be some might be some redistricting before the election. But what about this natural gerrymandering? I mean, we're concentrating all the Democratic votes in this I-85 corridor that you talked about, and people say, well, out in the rural areas, they've just cast their lot with Trump. But don't Democrats have something to offer the people who live in rural areas? Didn't the Democrats used to be the party of
rural areas?
What's happened?
They're going to have to. They're going to have to offer something to people in rural areas, partly because half of their base is out in the rural areas. I mean, if you look at the first congressional district, which is essentially a majority-minority, it's not quite majority, but it's a plurality-minority district down there in East North Carolina. We've got to keep those people in the fold, and you know, they're in very poor areas.
Well, what about white? What about white farmers and white? I mean, this is a
well. Look, I grew up in rural North Carolina, and I believe that we ought to be helping rural North Carolina anyhow. I mean, I think
regardless of race,
I think that what we need to be doing is looking at big infrastructure programs that can help economically start tie these rural areas to our more urban, faster growing parts of the state. Google Fiber's here in North Carolina, in Chapel Hill and Carrboro. It's not in Anson County. And it's not going to come to Anson County unless somebody makes it. You know, and whether it's Google Fiber or some sort of competitor, somehow we've got to get high-speed internet all over the state, because that nobody's going to an area that can't have it. And so, you know, my argument is if you had Google Fiber in a place like Wadesboro, where you can buy a house for $79,000 or $80,000, maybe you would have companies go down there and say, well, we got cheap labor, we got strong infrastructure, and this is a place we ought to go to expand.
We've just gotten started, Thomas Mills, but you got me more interested in things than even I was before we started. And I thank you, and I hope you'll come back after some of the smoke is cleared on this recent election.
Well, I sure will, and I appreciate you having me.
Thanks, Thomas Mills. Thanks for you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.